Dr. Paul O'Brien from the Academic Learning Centre at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick. You're very welcome to the programme and thank you for taking time to talk to us. How are you?
I'm very well, Gerard. It's an honour to be here chatting to a Clare man.
There you go. Well, now, Paul, actually, I'm a Limerick man that lives in Clare.
Oh, I'm out of here.
and I've lived in Clare when I'm in Ireland for longer than I lived in Limerick. But anyway, there you go.
I must have a chat with Ben when I meet him.
Do you? And I must say thanks to Ben for organising this as well. He was the go-between on this one. Paul, I want to talk to you about some papers that somebody threw into a skip. They had it stored somewhere and then somebody else threw them all into a skip. And somebody was passing by and thought, those boxes look interesting. I'll have a look and see. Am I right in saying that that's how these papers that we're talking about were found?
More or less, Chair. So about 30 years, well, I suppose I'll start my bit of the story first. I do a lot of free walking tours around Limerick City, generally in the spring and the summertime. And last August, the end of August, I think it was, I was giving a tour of O'Callaghan's and Clancy Strand in Limerick City. And we stopped at one particular house and there was a gentleman standing in his garden looking over at the tour and he was drinking a glass of wine.
Lovely.
And an older gentleman, perhaps in his 80s. And somebody said, you're talking about his house and he's drinking wine and not saying anything. So I felt a little uneasy, so I kind of turned my back towards him. Anyway, I spoke about his house, didn't know much in information about his house, and we continued on the tour. Mm-hmm. A couple of weeks passed, bumped into this gentleman on the street, and his name is Brendan Dennehy, and Brendan was with his son Nigel. And both of them invited me down to the house on O'Callaghan Street and their house, which, of course, as I said, I didn't have much information about.
Okay.
So down I went for a tour of the house with a friend of mine, Eddie Waldron, and another friend, Randall Hutkinson. And in we went, got a tour of this beautiful 1860s, 1870s house, discussed the house history and so forth. And as we were about to leave, Brendan said, Paul, in my own house, as it turned out, that house we were in there and then, that was his son's house, he said, in my own house on the Ennis Road, or in the North Circular Road, rather, I have something you might be interested in. He describes this archive, and I kind of thought, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. A few weeks passed anyway, and we went to view the archive, Randall and myself, and I was utterly, as I still am, shocked with what Brendan presented to me. So just to take up the story, the part of the story about the skip. So Brendan is a retired accountant and a very, very accomplished artist, I must say as well. But Brendan worked in the city for many years. He's a business in there, which his son has now taken over. And he said that he got a phone call about 30 years ago, it was about 91, 92, I think, a tip-off, as he called it,
right,
that a particular house or building on O'Connell Street, 74 O'Connell Street, was being emptied out.
Okay.
I believe there was a restaurant to go into the basement, into the cellar. So he went over, and the contents of the cellar were on the footpath, and ready to go into the skip. So Brendan recognized straight away the importance of the collection. So when I say the contents, many of you might have seen the photograph in my office a few weeks ago. So the contents are black tin or metal boxes. They're mm-hmm. fireproof boxes. The boxes themselves are very interesting because they mostly came from London and mostly date from about 1830 to about 1870 when they were created.
Wow.
Each box, nearly each box has a family name or a big house name embossed on the side of it. So straight away, Brendan, knowing his Limerick history, thought, these are important. These should be going into a skip. So he kind of rummaged through a few of the boxes, realized they were full of important documents and manuscripts and keys to family vaults and things like that, would you believe? And he thought, these can't go into the skip. If these go into the skip, they're lost forever.
Yeah.
So he quickly arranged to collect his car Acti's car with the boxes that he could manage to fit into the car, dropped him out to his house on the North Circular Road, turned the car around and came back into the city. But by the time Mickey got back to the building, perhaps an hour or two later, all the rest of the boxes were gone.
Oh.
There was no sign of anything. The building was locked up. There were no builders. There was no skip. There was no boxes. There was no anything. Just a scene of normality, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Very sadly, Jared, he reckons that he only managed to save about 20% of the collection. So 20% at the moment, I suppose, that equates to give or take 30 boxes. So the remaining 80%, hundreds of boxes, went probably into the skip, as they often do, or into the furnace. These days, very sadly, they go into professional shredding services.
Yuck.
The contractor comes in and they shred everything on site or off site in a secure location. Back then, everything goes to landfill or everything goes to the furnace.
Mm.
So that part of the story, speaking as a historian, is very, very sad.
It is.
However, the 30 boxes probably equate, I would guess, to maybe 300,000 plus individual documents. So take every letter, you know, in a bunch as an individual document. So that would be a conservative guess at the moment. So Brendan knew the collection was very important. He recognized the names on the boxes, the Earl of Limerick, the Stafford O'Briens from Cresslow Woods, Donat O'Brien from Drumolan Castle, other O'Briens from Cahermoyle, William Smith O'Brien from Cahermoyle in County Limerick, the Vereker family, who are Lord Gort up in Loch Cutra there, outside Gort in County Galway, and so forth. And of course, one of the boxes he recognised straight away was the Arthur box. And of course, Arthur's Quay, merchant family synonymous with the emergence and development of Georgian Limerick, and certainly with industrial Limerick.
Right.
So what did he do with the boxes? He brought them out to his house. He had every intention of going through them. However, he opened the first few and he thought, this is a mammoth task. I'm a young man, I have a family, I have a business, I have a lovely wife, I have a house to mind, and so forth.
Right.
So I suppose life just got in the way.
Hmm.
And he deposited them into the attic of his house. And when Randall and I went out about, must be just under 2 weeks ago now, we were in the attic and we kind of thought, we had seen a few of the boxes and we kind of thought, there's no way he could not have looked into these boxes. They're so interesting.
Right.
But there was probably an inch or 2 inches of dust and dirt accumulated over the years in the attic, and the boxes had not been touched until that brilliant day that he rescued them with Nigel back in the early 90s. So that's, I suppose, the story of the two-part story of the discovery of the boxes.
So give us an idea. You mentioned some of the families maybe that were involved, but give us some sense of the kinds of documents that you found. I think you mentioned that there were there deeds and were there keys and things like that.
So I suppose the collection originally, if you like, was put together by a land agent. And the land agent was tasked with managing the estates, the landed estates of a given area. So the collection or the business originally was a man called R.D. O'Brien. And he came from Cahermoyle House out in County Limerick, which is still extant.
Mm.
So he managed various estates throughout Limerick. Limerick, Clare, parts of Kerry, Cork, Tipperary, Galway.
Wow.
There are even estate records, Ger, from Laois, from Kilkenny, from Armagh, from Dublin.
Wow.
I was looking at a beautiful volume yesterday of maps from Finglas in Dublin. When Finglas was just green fields.
Wow.
So you can guess how old they are, going back into the 1810s and 20s. So I suppose the collection then is largely land-based. Mm-hmm. It's records of land and every part of the land from the ownership down. So we have rental books. If we're looking through, I suppose, the lens of a tenant, we have rental books. We have rental agreements. We have notes about evictions and ejectments from land for non-payment of rents. We can trace the value of land over maybe 150 or 200 year period. There are certainly, in the case of the MacDonald family, who are very interesting, their mansion house is still extant just outside Ennis in my home county. It's called New Hall House. Yes. You might be familiar with
it. I know it, yeah.
Beside Killone Lake there. Mm-hmm. So the MacDonald family were very large landowners and they owned a number of properties and a lot of land back in West Clare or in around Kilkee, Dunahad that way. There is a bunch of copies of leases and deeds to their properties. And the date range, 1675,
wow,
right through to about 1910. Now, I believe that family has died out. As such, there's no immediate family members that I know of. Obviously, there's descendants, but no direct family line members. Mm-hmm. For instance, today, Ger, after our interview, I'm traveling down to West Clare. And there's a house in Dunaha called Liscrona, which was the MacDonald family summer lodge, if you like, overlooking the Atlantic. And the current owners bought the house about 10 years ago. And they've been looking for information about the interior of the house. So I posted on West Clare Facebook history page there a few weeks ago a little snippet of the builder's accounts from that house.
Wow.
So I have it here in my office somewhere. So I got chatting then to the owners. And I am going today with Paddy Waldron down to the house. And I'm going to bring with me the 6-page handwritten builder's account of the house. So, for instance, the glass came from Dublin.
Wow.
The decorative ironwork was made by the Harrison Lee Foundry in Limerick, cost £3. The entire house cost £3 to build. It was designed by the very famous, £3,000. It was designed and built by the very famous James Payne, the architect based in Limerick. Of course, he's very famous, commissioned as Dromoland Castle. So it's very interesting. We know they were hauling stones from a quarry in Luped for the foundations. So this is that 1 6-page handwritten document, one of a kind, doesn't exist anywhere else. We can trace the cost of the building right down to the tiles in front of the front door.
Incredible.
And those tiles are still there today.
That's fantastic.
So that's, I suppose, the type of detail, fine detail that's in the collection. However, in the MacDonald box as well, we know that all of the townlands and all of the land that the family owned as landlords, as merchants. We have a full list, I think practically a full list of all their tenants over a period of about 110 years.
Okay.
So we know, for instance, for argument's sake, for my grandfather back in West Clare, what land he was occupying, the rent he was paying, and if he was doing any improvement to the land, that all of that is documented. And that's just one box, one of 30.
What's the importance of all of the, now you haven't obviously gotten through all of the information yet, but what is the importance for us today and maybe for other generations to come?
I suppose just to understand, I suppose in the basic sense, what was a landed estate? It's not really a phrase or a term we use these days. So what was the land of the state and how it worked and how it functioned?
Hmm.
Most people in Ireland will know stories of landlords and the landlord castes and so forth. We'll know stories of terrible and brutal evictions during the famine years and how Ireland was depopulated because of the famine. However, we don't know we don't know the names of tenants. We don't know, for instance, if we choose Dunaha townland in West Clare, for argument's sake, we know how many people occupy that land, how they eat out their living on a small patch of land.
Mm.
We know things like that already. However, we now know their names.
Mm.
We know who lived where and when. We know how and perhaps why they might have chosen to immigrate in post-famine Ireland, particularly if their holding was just too small, if the land was going to be consolidated.
Right.
We know how people were pushed off the land. But I suppose we can give agency to hundreds and hundreds of tenant voices, which are really just lost to time.
Mm-hmm.
We can map things. I was looking at it as a hand-drawn and hand-painted map of Rathkeel from 1790 yesterday.
Mm.
And in the little legend, it says 331 houses to the front and 22 houses to the back. We have various houses drawn into the map, merchant houses, landed houses, so forth. But very interestingly, we have the land surveyor's name, a chap called Paul Rahilly. And I went looking for him in newspaper archives yesterday, and I discovered that he died at Newcastle West on, I think, was the 22nd of April in 1809. And he's described as a land surveyor. And here we have possibly the only example of his very, very fine work.
Wow.
So that, I suppose, the geographical data contained in the maps will help us to map the landscape.
Mm. We know as well that a lot of documents were lost during the Civil War, where all the papers were stored in Dublin went on fire. And I know that a lot were reconstructed down through the years. We spoke to somebody on the program recently about the launch of that. But will these papers be added, or can they be added, or can they fill gaps that may have been left because of those documents that were destroyed?
Yeah, certainly. I've already spoke to a colleague involved in that project in Dublin. So any wills, for instance, that were proved in Dublin prior to the Four Courts fire in 1922, they went up in smoke. And I know from glancing, and you said it yourself there, Chair, it's only a cursory glance. We've had time-wise with the archive so far, but there are countless wills in there. So a lot of those gaps can be plugged. And of course, a will is a very valuable document because it sets out all the lists of who's related to who got what, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe hundreds, probably thousands of wills, for instance, went up in smoke in 1922. So that will certainly help to plug some of the gaps. And certainly, and I suppose if I want to be parochial about it, some of the gap for West Clare and for Munster, for this part of the country, which is great.
What's going to happen now with the papers once you have looked through them, once you've absorbed them? Maybe do you digitise them? You know, where are these papers going to end up?
So it's a good question. So we will work very closely with a professional archivist, and that person will advise us on next steps. But we've had, I suppose, chats already. So it is our intention to catalogue the collection professionally. That will take a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
Write it up, you know. I suppose the thing to remember with the collection, as we're calling it, I'm using that term very loosely, It's not a collection related to one such family. I suppose it's a series of mini collections within an overall collection. So each box will have to be catalogued on its own. Each story of each family and their land and their business interests and so forth, all that will have to be written up separately. So it'll take a long time to catalogue it. It'll take an extra, a very long time to digitise it. However, we have applied for funding to the Heritage Council and to others already, and to other sources externally and internally here in the college. Ultimately, it's our intention that the archive will be made available to researchers, to historians, to scholars, to people who just want to take a look, if you like. Already, I've been in touch with a number of families whose estates are represented in the boxes. And just last week, last Friday, I invited in two gentlemen from one of the Clare houses into the office, and they went through their boxes with great interest.
Right.
And they were able to inform me of the story of their house, their estate, and these two particular boxes. They represent family member from about the 1890s. So they were able to fill me in with his biography, which is great. So already, I suppose, partnerships and collaborations are in place, which is really important for the collection. It's faster, as I said, conservatively, 250,000-300,000 documents. We still have another, I think, 8 boxes to collect.
Okay.
From Brendan's house. Space is becoming a small bit of an issue, but we'll find it somewhere. We're very lucky here in Mary Eye to have a record room which is fireproof and waterproof. Great. And so forth. So everything is stored very, very securely. One of the boxes which has yet to come on site is Limerick in the 17th century.
Wow.
So Brendan was telling us there are documents in there related to Cromwellian Limerick.
Wow.
And even before that, he said the earliest document he spotted is 1620. So the earliest document here in the college we have seen so far is a lease, a MacDonald lease for 1670, I think. But this is pushing it back 50 years again, and also included in the 17th century box, if you like, what we're calling it for now, is a wax seal, about this size, a wax seal of King James II from the time of the siege of Limerick in 1690. Now, I haven't clapped eyes on that myself yet, but Brendan assures me it's there and it's in mint condition. As I said, it's large.
What's it like putting your fingers on a piece of paper that's been around since the early 1600s or mid 1600s?
Yeah, I suppose it's something I've never really, I've worked with a lot of archives at this stage. I always have a huge smile on my face when I pick something up that perhaps hasn't looked at or handled perhaps in 150 years. It's a huge thrill. I can't help but think, first of all, who made the paper? Where did the paper come from? The writing is so beautiful.
Really?
The penmanship is extraordinary. So I think the person who made the paper, industrialist who made the paper, then the clerk who perhaps recorded the details, it's a beautiful hand in most cases. And I think, what trouble did this document perhaps cause?
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's lost, what trouble did it cause because it has been lost over the years? But I suppose mostly I just think what a privilege it is, to be working with primary material that has never really been worked on before, beyond its intended purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It was very thrilling last week when I opened, I suppose we call it a dowry or a marriage cert or whatever, a marriage contract, to use that non-love mm-hmm. term. So we unfolded a marriage contract dated from 1803, an enormous document, about the size of a sheet of paper and a flip chart on its side. Every square inch of it written on. And at the very end, we have three wax seals.
Okay.
And it's a legal document. It's a contract, a marriage contract. And I believe that if the document didn't have the wax seals, it wasn't considered official or legal. Right. These days we have sworn affidavits and things like that. But the wax seal, one of the wax seals was the Arthur family, who obviously played such a prominent role in public life in Limerick City and built half of it. So there's this wax seal and a name, Thomas Arthur Esquire, 1803. And you're just holding that going, it's a marriage contract. It's pretty, I suppose, generic in its content. However, it was never made for public consumption.
Mm-hmm.
So beyond the family, beyond the legal people, solicitors and so forth, nobody will ever have seen it before, and it's printed on vellum, so it's a beautiful document. It's a piece of art, essentially. And here it is, nearly 220 years later, in mint condition, like it was put together yesterday. So it's a huge, huge privilege to work with primary material.
Before I let you go, one final question. Will any of this be on public display at any point, or have you even thought like that?
Well, we thought a little bit, I suppose, Ger. Quite apart from the landed material in the archive, R.D. O'Brien was clearly the land agent for St. Mary's Cathedral in Limerick as well. So he handled a lot of their books and their accounts. And there was a woman in Limerick called Alice Craven. She died in 1726. And we know because I have her will in my office. She died in 1726. She was a woman of some means. Her husband had been mayor of the city in 1708. He predeceased her, I think, Richard Craven. And she left all her worldly possessions to education and to charity. It was administered by the Bishop of Limerick in St. Mary's. And he established the Blue Coat School with the funds, and he also established widows' almshouses in her name. The Alice Craven Trust is still extant, nearly 200 years later. The Blue School material is fascinating. So the Blue School was in the back of St. Mary's Cathedral. The room is still there, but the material is so rich that I can tell you what colour the skirting boards were painted.
Wow.
What colour the uniforms were, where the material for the uniforms are purchased in the city, how much the caretaker was paid for sweeping out the room once a week, where the salary of the teachers, where the teacher's horse was parked, if you like. So all that material is in there. So with that, we early days yet, but we would hope perhaps to have an exhibition of the Blue School material in the Blue School room in St. Mary's Cathedral sometime in the next 6 months.
Well, we look forward
to
that.
So it's great.
All right.
Just one final thing, sir.
Sure.
Sorry, I meant to say it. In one of the boxes, there's an envelope. And in the envelope, written on the envelope, it says keys to vaults.
Oh, yes.
Two very large keys. So the Dean of St. Mary's, the Reverend Niles Sloan, was here last week, and he looked at the keys and he said, "I think they will fit one of the vaults in St. Mary's Cathedral." And there are actually only about four or five vaults in the cathedral. So we are going down, I think, next week.
Brilliant.
With Nigel Dennehy, the son of the guy who found the archive. Nigel's wife and his two sons who are history nuts.
Oh.
And they've been, the people down in St. Mary's have been, I suppose, oiling the locks of the mausoleum down there. And we're going to see if the keys will, in fact, open one of the mausoleums down there. So
magic.
That'll be very exciting. So we're going to film that and put it, hopefully put it on social media.
Brilliant.
Just the opening bit, obviously, not the in the interior of the mausoleum.
If there's something that you can talk about after that, will you get in contact with me and let me know what you found? That'd be fantastic. Dr. Paul O'Brien, thanks a million for talking to us about this fabulous collection that... has just landed in your lap, basically, and I can tell how excited you are about it, and just listening to it and listening to the stories of it, it must be just fascinating. I leave you alone because I know you're heading off, and thank you for joining us from the Academic Learning Centre at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick. Thanks, Dr. Paul O'Brien.
Thanks, sir.